Specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassinations, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media.
Chuck O'Kelly! Yeah!
31st day of January 2019, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. This indeed is the O'Kelly Effect, broadcast live from the facilities of O'Kelly.com, but also heard in a variety of other places, occasionally rebroadcast, reused, repackaged, and reissued via your, various facilities that would apply to your fondle slab of choice. There we go. I'm trying to change up my wording. Anyway, it is a Thursday, that is, that part of the week. And last night, well, there was a reason why I wasn't live, but anyway, I am live today, and it is very happy for me to do this because, there's a bit of an appendix, if you will, and I do mean it in the literary sense and probably in the physical sense, an appendix, which needs to be added to a series that has been going on the show for quite some time, and we've gotten some very interesting feedback about it, but tonight is not really about me, so I'm getting all my announcing out of the way right away because I have Carmine Savastano with me, who is the author of Two Princes and a King. Of course, you go to TPAAK.com, and you can check out not only his book, but his work related to the assassinations of the 60s, most particularly the ones that are reviewed in the book, Two Princes and a King, a concise review of both the Kennedy's brothers' assassinations, that is, JFK and RFK being the two princes and the king being Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., obviously. Anyway, you go over there, you do that, you find out a lot. Meanwhile, we also have a Larry Hancock with us who, really, if I get into the diversity of the amount of different subjects, I mean, it's a lot of national security stuff. You learn a lot about the behaviors of the government through Larry's work. But then again, also focused on the assassinations through some of his writings. Dr. King, a couple of books on that, which he co-authored, but also a slew of books. And if you go to Larry-Hancock.com, guess what? You can find out about that. Catch up on Larry's blog. I think his blog is running full time again. For a little while, there was a little stall, but anyway, lots of stuff. And we've talked to Larry on this show about everything from Russia to UFOs to the behavior again of various paradigms being put into place post disaster regarding attacks by alleged enemies of all sorts, but also the assassinations, all that stuff. What we're doing tonight is a continuation of the JFK 101 series. Now, it really doesn't have much more to go, so it might be that we have to go into 201. Is that how class, it's been so long since I've looked at academic stuff. I think you go 201 when it's like the second year. I don't know. We're going to have to figure that one out if we have to go further. Carmine.
Someone emailed me a suggestion that maybe we might want to go with just season two, JFK. Stay with 101 and just season two. series two.
JFK 101B. just start putting letters on it.
They don't get lost with the 201, a 301, a 401.
that could be interesting. And, of course, when I was looking around at comments recently, Carmine, I found it remarkable that there are still people that complain about Carmine laughing, on shows that are 5 years old.
What are you going to do?
I find it hysterical. You know who nobody ever complains about, Carmine? Larry Hancock. Larry, how are you doing tonight?
That's just because I'm so lovable.
Exactly. Larry's a much more shiny personality than I am.
Although recently I did discover somebody was mad at you, and I'll talk to you off the air about it.
Okay, well, tell me to get in line.
As long as they're far, far away.
Yeah, far away enough. Anyway, enough of all that. What is it that we're going to discuss tonight? Well, we went through each of the official investigations in my mind that were of significance, that were certainly organized and either had an element related directly to the JFK assassination or were – completely engaged with nothing but the JFK assassination, whether it be, you know, the HSCA, which was half about the JFK assassination, half about the MLK assassination. We went through the Warren Commission. We went through, wait a minute, what else did we do? The ARRB. I'm going totally out of order, because if you don't know these, then what you need to do is go back and listen to the series. Anyway, we went through the details of them and gave you three interesting snapshots, three different angles sort of going at this, and at all times kind of got together and discussed the context of each of the official investigations. Now, that is not to say that that's all that's ever gone on, but it is an excellent part to start from when it comes to learning about the assassination, because, listen, at some point or other, everybody has to refer to the official investigations, whether it is to debunk them, to show that they were correct, to show that it was, you know, something that needs to be further examined, to show what they didn't look into. So, you know, no matter who you are or what your view is on the assassination, if you care about the evidence, you've got to work with the official evidence at some point. So we did that. But now we have a bit of an addendum, and Larry, is there anything you want to add in before I kind of turn it over to Carmine?
No, I think our addendum is really the point that, you know, it's been now almost two decades since the work of the ARB. We've had tens of thousands of documents released. Beyond that, we should have been able to do some more research. So a bit of this is on us, too, you know. We complained that they didn't do a good enough job, and we wanted to see everything they had, and now we got it.
Well, you know, to some degree, there's still stuff being withheld. There's still questionable things, you know, that one could. But let's put our complaints aside and just agree that a great deal more material is accessible to the public now, is easily attained. You don't have to go to, you know, to D.C. You know, you don't have to go to the National Archives. You don't have to go to Texas to get a lot of the material that you can now access directly online, that you can get through other means. There is reliable ways to collect evidence. There are great websites like the Mary Farrell Foundation, I always screw up the other one, but the Assassination Records Archive guys over there.
Assassination Archives Review, or Assassination Records Review. Now you got me going.
Yep, see?
Like with Patricia Johnson and McMillan.
Yeah, right.
I've laughed with Alan Dale about that before, about always confusing the AARB and the AARC, the Assassination Archives Review Center.
That's it. Or is it – isn't archive in there?
A record center. Yeah. Now review board. Ah. Oh.
See? Listen, it's out there. I'm going to give you guys links to these websites, okay, with the podcast, so that you don't have to rely on us. You know, and that's the funny thing, is that so many things are similarly named and seem to get convoluted together. It's easy to mix things up. But those two resources – are absolutely
Assassination Archives and Research Center is what we meant to say.
That's it. I knew the word archives was in there.
What's crazy is I know it's even founded by Bernard Fensterwald and Jim Lassar, but I still, for some reason, that damn name, whenever, and we talked about the AARB just before it, so of course that set it up nicely.
Right, and this is what happens, you know, and also, you know, the Mary Farrell Foundation, right, that one actually becomes a little bit screwed up when people say it out loud. But these are essential websites. I have them bookmarked on any machine I've ever had, pretty much. It's like, I always got to find those and put them in there. And that's been true for, oh, I don't know, at least 15 years, something like this, I think. Or I don't know. It's kind of confusing as to when it actually all got rolling. But there have been a great many efforts to make this stuff much more accessible. And so on and so forth. We're gonna provide you with a couple other links and things along the way tonight, and a few other resources. But the big question is that, considering the fact that there is a great deal more material available, you know, more now than there was 10 years ago, much more now than there was 30 years ago, right? A great deal more than there could have been 40 years ago, a ton more than there was 50 years ago, you know, and it just progressively seems to increase. You would think with the pile, the mountain of evidence that has been developed both in public and private hands, that, you know, there might be many more consensuses being reached by those who are concerned with it. But anyway, that's another thing.
Conversely, there's also another pile that has formed.
Well, right. And that's what we talked about on myths, you know.
Later on, I hope you don't mind. I do want to touch quickly upon a more recent one that I missed for the last episode.
Oh, sure.
Just one that ties into the rest of what we're going to be discussing. But anyway.
If nothing else, we can always go over time and discuss it if we get, you know, bogged down in the details of the other
stuff. Yeah. It's only a couple paragraphs that I have notes for, so.
Which, by the way, big ups to Mike Swanson for taking the segment with Joan Mellon off of the last Myths episode. It's now a separate YouTube video. I put that in the chat room at Ochelli.com if you guys want to hear just that portion of the show. But that whole show is pretty interesting, although it took me many, many hours of editing to fix it because of all the technical difficulties with the live show, which we are not having tonight. Keep your fingers crossed. So I'd like to turn it over to Carmine at this point and get the conversation actually rolling.
Okay. So picking up, I suppose, from where we left off, with the dissolution of the Assassination Records Review Board and the release of their files, a resurgence of activity commenced. Now, as the longtime listeners know, since we began the 101 series almost 2 years ago, it has expanded now into this 16th episode, and hopefully laid the groundwork for those who seek to understand the case with more clarity and substantial evidence. A summary of everything we covered might consume this entire show tonight, so I've linked a playlist of all the prior shows for reference, and the period discussed covers most of the major investigations and events that occurred within additional context and evidence. With that said, we can wade into the current state of the case and what the future may hold from where we left off. So, from the ARRB, new statements, testimony, and leads were offered. Formerly declassified files slowly were discovered and used to expand the public's knowledge. While several historians and researchers pored over the new files and made progress in certain areas of controversy, others were determined to push stories and assertions without evidence. If the 1970s was the decade of JFK congressional investigations with multiple important official inquiries, the 90s instead just saw the review board and the proliferation of bad ideas.
Well, one thing that you didn't quite mention there in the descriptor about the advances made during the releases from the ARRB over time is not only was new evidence released and previously declassified stuff finally declassified, but there were also, this is the painful part of it, by the way, a bunch of documents which, you know, might have had, 20 lines redacted. Well, now maybe they had 10 lines redacted. And some of the black strips across the documentation lightened up a little bit, changed around. And there's even the weirdness, and I want to get Larry's commentary on this before you go further. There's even the weirdness of some of this stuff being reclassified after it was declassified, which is another thing that went on post-ARRB. So altogether, I kind of throw that in your lap, Larry. There's a lot of nuances to what's new, what's kind of new, and what's really, really new when it comes to JFK evidence post-Oliver Stone film and the declaration made by Congress, the law actually put into place that, the JFK Records Collection Act is a law, right? And it's still there, but it no longer has a mechanism by which to enforce said law. Anyway, a lot of things to talk about there. Larry.
I think one of the major things that drove that, if you look at the timing of it all, most of the ARB work was released, I would say, and put online during from like 96 to 2000. And then what happened, of course, in the attack on America was a huge resurgence of classification. And we see this not only with the JFK records, but I see it in a great number of other types of national intelligence documents. They just unleashed a whole suite of reclassification. They pulled documents back that had been out there. They reclassified documents that were out there. And they began, and this is a different set of people, okay? One set of people had released things under their interpretation of the guidelines. Now there are stronger interpretations of the guidelines, and they started pulling back and putting in redactions. And so we tend to think of it only in JFK documents, but I can assure you that I see it all over the place.
Well, and the interesting thing there is that the major factor is really the reshaping, if you will, of the national security state and its standards and its people, kind of post 9/11. Let's get down to brass tacks. This is what changed things a lot, number one. But the end result, number two, the end result here is that, quite frankly, you and I, Larry, theoretically could believe that we're looking at the very same document, which Carmine could be a third person requesting it. And here's the fun part. Carmine might get told it's classified. He can't have it. You and I might have a copy of it, and our copies might have different redactions on them, depending on when it is we acquired them and how. Isn't that true?
And I could request it right now and be denied it.
Well, yeah, that's why I brought Carmine in as the third guy, saying, you know, basically giving him the order of who got into the case in that order, right? The thing is, he could request a document that you and I have seen that is no longer available and that you and I even have copies of that differ from each other. I mean, this is part of the reality. Am I right or wrong?
And that's just if you use the actual chain of evidence. That doesn't even include all the other versions of that document that might have been created over the years, too.
Oh, yeah, but I'm saying let's stick with source,
yeah.
Right? Legitimate acquisition of the document mm-hmm. through regular
and
requests.
It could still be different. Yeah.
They could all be different, and one person could even be denied in a three-person scenario. So some confusion is bound to come from all of this. When it comes to a lot of the particulars, Larry, really quickly, and then I'd like Carmine to pick back up.
Well, and there is another element that added the confusion that many folks may not realize, and that is that when the ARB finished its work and released lots of new documents and lots of new versions, they weren't integrated into the existing collection. They were integrated in. You didn't have a whole set of boxes going, oh, this is the new stuff, go look at it. You had to go back through the old stuff and try to find it yourself, which left you in exactly the situation you're talking about, Chuck. It's sort of like, I've seen this before. Oh, well, maybe I haven't. Is it different? Is it new? You know, very confusing.
Mm. And it's highly improbable that it was done coincidentally. They didn't just accidentally dump everything back together and then throw it all over the place.
Right. It would have been easier to put it in separate boxes and just point to the corner of the room. Clearly, it took more work to do this.
Well, and now if you don't want someone to find something, that makes a lot more sense.
Well, see, that's the funny thing, is this resulted in what they call the JFK Records Collection. And the records collection is not just restricted to what was released through the Records Collection Act. And so you have stuff that could have been floating around for a long time, like you said, being sort of reshuffled into, it's like shuffling a bunch of cards that look similar together. And now you've got to examine them and figure out, well, this card looks a little older. This one, I mean, literally, this is what you're dealing with over there. And, again, like I said, there's a lot of well-meaning confusion that could arise from this process, and it's kind of almost a disadvantage to people who were there before this stuff took place, because now you have to, again, like you said, revisit things that, have I seen this before? Sure, I think I have. Wait a minute, maybe I haven't, because there's new information here, or maybe there isn't. You know, it's a challenge, to say the least, Larry, wouldn't you say?
That's true, but it's still better than using YouTube as your source.
There
true.
You go.
Or Wikipedia.
That's true as well. I mean, you know, when you got a council of people deciding what is legitimate and what isn't based on their own agendas as opposed to, anyway, another thing, maybe we should do a show on Wikipedia at some point.
But I also want to say, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Larry.
I think that there's a special investigation going on about that now already. Just kidding.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a tertiary source. Anybody can edit. How much less reliable do you think?
I was thinking of something more contemporary in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, there's always that as well. But Carmine, I wanted to make sure we entered this kind of element into the discussion so that...
It's important that people realize that there is going to be a lot of confusion, not all of it nefarious, but there definitely are motivations to make... Well, and there is actually a silver lining. If there can be a silver lining found in the confusion that they generated by doing it the way they did, it's that what you can do with multiple copies of a document is sometimes, as Chuck said, they will redact different parts. So you can actually piece together the different redacted documents and maybe come up with a whole document.
Which is a funny thing, too, because that's actually happened on some occasions where, you know, they've reclassified something, so it's disappeared. But meanwhile, they've declassified something else, and if you put the two documents together, you get a much better idea of what was going on and almost get the whole thing. I mean, this happens, too. I just wanted to make it very clear, because a lot of people figure that documents are, you know, just solid. They are as they are, and there's, you know, well, how could you look at a document and a guy said this 10, 15 years ago, and somebody else says something totally different? In some cases, people are not lying or misrepresenting what they saw. It's just that the evidence might have changed. So I just want to make that clear that has happened.
Well, Chuck, if I could just add to that point, because I had this exchange with Carmine. One of the reasons I commented earlier that the onus was on us is now that we can see documents that we didn't see before, parts of them we didn't see before, many things that were mysterious in the first few decades are no longer mysterious. We can see the full story now, yet people... I'm not kidding. Still do talk on forums, still do post on the internet about things as being mysterious and suspicious and conspiratorial that have been resolved long ago if you actually look at the documents. So the onus is really on us to keep up to date and for people just not to keep repeating books, things out of books from 40 years ago.
Well, right. I mean, and here's an interesting case in point, which I'll use as an example where I'm not picking on anybody here. But, you know, when I see the revered status of David Lifton with a lot of people and how great he is and how well studied he is and all that. And then he says things like, look, I don't need to look at any of the new evidence. That to me means that you've decided that you knew all you needed to know to begin with, which he says. And people still stick by this, and some people parrot it and say, look, all that needed to be known was known then. I disagree. And I think if you look at this objectively, you'd find that, you know, Mr. Lifton and people who think like him could learn a great deal about some of the things that did seem rather mysterious, odd, inconsistent in the documents. They may have been made whole or a lot more sensible now through later or different releases. And this is something that needs to be kept in mind. So, but a lot of people who don't look at the documents and just look to people like, you know, you, Larry, or others who write about this or talk about it and try and display it to the general public, in a lot of cases, people are under this strange misconception that, well, a document's a document's a document. And maybe they gave us a little more now, but actually it hasn't just been newly revealed things. There's been a cycle of all sorts of alterations that have occurred during this process because of, again, the shape of the national security state, the change in the attitude and interpretation of what should be and should not be released, and this really curious filing process that the National Archives has gone through. So all of those things combine to create some legitimate confusion that really is not the easiest thing in the world to resolve. So that's why I always caution people when they say, look, I've got the document, and I think, okay, let's take a look at this. Let's see if it is the newest version of it. Is it better than the old version anyway, you know, so on and so forth. You can't, I can never give snap answers to most of this stuff unless people are showing me something that's been fabricated or obviously altered by someone, through other processes in the private sector, if you will. So with all that in mind, Carmine, go ahead.
So as Chuck mentioned briefly before, one significant development in the 1990s was the formation of the Mary Farrell Foundation and History Matters, two websites with expansive online document collections that have grown by collaboration with the Assassination Archives and Research Center, formed in the 1980s, into over a million pages of official documents. This public collaboration has produced more verifiable and accessible evidence in two decades for the public than most related officials and mythmakers ever will. Because of the work of people like Mary Farrell, Jim Lazar, Rex Bradford, and several others, more credible information and evidence has been given the opportunity for review. Without these contributions, most would be forced to rely wholly on official pronouncements and public assertions, lacking definitive proof that often suffer from biased internal agendas. As the 90s progressed, another wave of researchers emerged, and both conspiracy advocates and critics continued debating the case. But the significant resurgence began to fade in some respects, with current events dominating the public's attention. While supporters of the President's Commission largely have shared the same narrative for the entirety of the case, several conspiracy advocates have significantly divergent ideas that could not be easily assembled into one narrative. Add to this repeated official interference, the suppression of evidence, public rumors, tabloid promotion, and some completely unreasonable bad actors without evidence. It did not take long to further fracture the already divided research community, and with each growing internal attack, more time and effort would be wasted. Yet the supporters of the official story, even with a semi-cohesive narrative, are just as beset with holes in their evidence. With each new release of documents and inspection, the past record has evolved from what the government once believed into what they later would admit. The intensive first investigation of the CIA and FBI combined did not last a week before the assumption of Oswald's guilt. The group of wise men forming the commission were lied to by several people within their own investigation, and members of the commission itself withheld information regarding prior and ongoing assassination plots. Indeed, the prior firm official denial of any conspiracy to occlude the facts transformed into later claims of a benign conspiracy, or withholdings for national security purposes. Yet, despite these and many other inconsistencies, some are just as committed to the official narration of events as mythmakers are to their chosen beliefs. A more balanced approach might prevent the continuing unfortunate habit by several people on both sides to declare victory before presenting the facts required to do so. It is quite instructive that dozens, perhaps hundreds of people on all sides have claimed to have solved the JFK case, but not a single person has ever thus far been correct definitively.
You know, an interesting thing that I thought of while listening to that part from you, Carmine, is, and we can capsulize and illustrate exactly what you were just talking about through one very simple thing. Alan Dulles, who was on the Warren Commission, who, when we got to look at the executive sessions many years later, you could realize, you could analyze, you could understand that not only was this man withholding information that he should have been privy to, but he was also steering the commission and steering discussions and an active participant in, well, kind of misleading the operation. Regardless of what you think of the legitimate intent of the commission was or the motives of its members, you have Alan Dulles playing a game in there, which I think is a fair statement to make. Now, does that mean that Alan Dulles is directly responsible for any portion of anything? That's another question. But the thing is, this has led to a lot of argument over something that, you know, is kind of strange as the evidence has developed. Larry, I think you might have something to say about this particular topic.
Well, I do, and let me give you another example that has just come to our attention within the last week. My friend David Boylan came up with a new document, and we did some more searching based on the names in it. And this is a fascinating example of how these new documents are bringing old things into question. In this case, we now learn that five CIA officers went to visit one of the members of the Warren Commission. I'm not going to go into detail, but they actually physically went to visit him, and they had a simple request. They pointed out that the FBI had turned over all of their investigative reports about Lee Oswald in Miami to the Warren Commission, and the CIA felt that this was not in the interest of national security, so they kindly asked the Warren Commissioner to give them all that material back. Not to the FBI, of course, but to the CIA. And the kindly Warren Commission member said, oh, of course, if you think this is an issue of national security, here, why don't you five gentlemen pick it all up and carry it away with you? And they did.
Mm.
And I don't think any of us have really seen much about an FBI investigation of Lee Oswald in Florida.
I can't say that I recall anything of significance regarding Lee Harvey Oswald in Florida at any point in time.
But clearly there was. And I mean, knowing the FBI, they may have just been covering bases. They may have, they could, there could be reports. I do know there were reports out of the Cuban exile community. You don't know what was in it. And it might not have even have been factual. The FBI just takes reports. But if they could do that, doesn't it just make you ponder? It's sort of like, you're investigating this and we'd like that stuff back. Okay, you haven't finished your investigation. Has anybody else seen this? Well, no. Okay, but give it back to us now, okay?
Well, and I would say, well, it. I think what Larry guessed that could be in them is likely probably what was. They wanted to, I mean, it could be something more nefarious. It could be something bigger. And if someone can find one of those things or definitively prove it, then they'll be right about that. But I think more likely it was they wanted to purge any mention of Oswald. Because they knew that any document with his name on it that was a CIA document builds the case against them.
It certainly could be, but when you're stuck on the one point that this is in months, I mean, it's not at the end of the investigation, this thing is still alive in progress. If you have one agency collecting material that another agency has supplied the investigation, it does raise doubts as to the...
Oh. The veracity,
the effectiveness, the, okay.
Yeah, they were undercutting each other. The arms weren't working together. And we, you know, I mean, from Hoover's perspective, they never were. Hoover was always trying to undercut the CIA and get to information before they could so he could sanitize the portions he wanted to.
Well, see, there's all that, Carmine. That's true. But, you know, there's another aspect here, which could be that although the, let's call them the Miami Files for the sake of discussion, let's just say they didn't really contain anything of significant evidence directly to the case, but you never know what could be there in an ancillary fashion.
Oh, I think they could be valuable, Chuck. I'm just saying that they didn't care about, you know, for us, I think they definitely could have been valuable leads. But I don't think the CIA was doing it because they wanted to cover up anything with the plot. I think they wanted to cover any track, like when they lied about McMillan Johnson or when they lied about McVicker. You know, that wasn't because they were trying, you know, to directly send Oswald towards Kennedy. It was because they likely were putting him in a net and following him around. And they knew that if people could link their people to him, the implications, that is, that, you know, they had something later to do with the assassination. That's just how I perceive it. I'm not saying that's the definitive view.
Well, yeah, right. That's how you're perceiving it. But, Larry, let me just enter something into here. See, now here's the funny thing, Carmine. Just because that's how you perceive it doesn't mean that you can state that with any sort of authority, because guess what?
Well,
we don't have them.
Analysis, I understand, is based on the perception of the person. But what I can say is that we do have the evidence to show that those are the reasons they lied in those cases. So it would just be more perception alone to say that these files mean anything more than them just probably trying to get rid of mentions in the record.
Right, but to ascribe a motive or to even begin to reasonably ascribe a motive, I would not do that without having the evidence in hand. And the fact that it was intentionally removed from the official investigators and has also not surfaced basically ever after.
It was probably destroyed, just like the Secret Service records, just like the Mexico City tapes.
Mm-hmm. So,
you know,
I'm
not saying that there isn't, there is no dishonesty there. There's plenty of dishonesty. I'm just not willing to jump to the farthest edge of that dishonesty could be.
This is where my strange sense of humor intrudes. I mean, we know about the conversation between the commissioners when they're saying, well, all our stuff is coming from Hoover and we don't think he'll give us anything really, you know, that would be embarrassing, and you know, we're not sure that we can trust him. Can't you just see the additional the conversation that goes, well, yeah, if he does, the CIA will probably ask for it back.
Oh, the one that always sticks out to me is Russell when Dulles goes, I want to get all this stuff over to the CIA as soon as possible. And Russell goes, they'll doctor anything they hand to us.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, people who are looking to these intelligence agencies to be honest are going to be disappointed. They might give some honest analysis on occasion to their bosses, but they're not in the business of providing honest clarity to the public.
Well, no, absolutely not. But it's just fascinating to me, though, that, you know, you have, and I guarantee you there's more than this that just disappeared because,
oh yeah,
you know, it wasn't requested, somehow wasn't collected, was collected, but was considered insignificant. I guarantee you there's a lot of lost stuff. Not saying that there are, you know, the smoking guns in any of these boxes of files or whatever, but also we have no way of proving that there isn't either. Because we don't have them. So, you know, here it is. You're now left to your own interpretation of something that is not available to you. Okay.
Well, and I'm, for me personally, everyone, you know, is going to come to their own decision how they want to interpret the evidence and, you know, whether or not it exists. But the default, at least, position usually in the scientific method is if you don't have evidence for it, it doesn't exist. If you can't prove it, you're just guessing. So it's fine. That can lead us to new leads, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's something concrete that someone should stake a lot of their time and attention on.
Right. And this is the interesting thing about yours and my worldview a little bit, is the way that we interpret the missing evidence in some cases is fascinating, because I'm always about the idea that a lot of things are part of the world that cannot be entered into evidence. You know what I mean? And that's just part of the reality. And we had that discussion before, which,
yeah,
again, I think is an interesting point. But
well, and philosophically, I think that that's true. There are a lot of things that can't be accounted for with, you know, just even existence. If you want to get into the deepest philosophical arguments where people say you can't even prove existence and that we're here having this conversation right now. But I tend to think it is occurring.
No, I gotcha.
Yeah, you know, I mean, but it is, but in this realm, I'm so, you know, hypercritical of anything that we don't have substantial evidence for, because in this realm, it's so easy to get misled.
Well, right, and people tend to start to weave things from that base as opposed to simply looking at it and stating it for what it is, which is often a problem, too.
But so, that's why you're here, to keep me from,
yeah,
for keep me to slipping into dogma and
there you go. There, each of us is keeping each other in check with that particular bookend of the philosophical debate. So that's why it's good. Anyway,
yeah. Well, I'm here to tell the jokes.
Larry's here for jokes and context.
Exactly. Anyway, so moving forward.
Yeah, so the debate has ebbed and flowed in the intervening years, but with the rise of the internet communication, a greater number of people could participate in the case to the benefit and, unfortunately, sometimes the detriment of various related subjects. The most recent resurgence of public interest corresponded with the 50th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. In 2013, a fourth generation of research was emerging that enlisted additional historians, scientists, criminal justice professionals, former officials, former investigators, experts, and authors. It was just prior to that time that I began to take significant interest in the matter. I would soon, from listening to shows like Chuck's and listening to shows that Larry was on, and, you know, people like Rex Bradford, Bill Simpich, John Newman, Alan Dale, you know, we've talked about lots of people, Mike Swanson, Rob Clark. So I noticed that a common problem with some people operating in the case was that they didn't have substantial evidence, and that because they didn't have it, they were then forced to then attack people or seek to discredit people because they didn't have the facts to back their argument up. Mm. So essentially what I, you know, hopefully have helped bring, in addition to others that have brought it to the case, is if you have no facts to verify your claims, there's no reason to support them. That is my credo. Some people, you know, they want to believe things, and some people want to know them. And that's the difference between research and storytelling. Hmm. So I think that is that's a big difference. I think that is I've seen occur in the years that I was getting involved, you know, working with people like you guys and working with a lot of good people, you know, at the Lancer conferences and people I've met from writing the book. And I've seen a lot more people using evidence, and that is heartening. I hope that it continues. I hope that, you know, we challenge not just the beliefs that we oppose, but also our own when the new evidence comes out. Because we're going to have to change things. There's going to have to be an evolution to this.
All right.
And we can't get... Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, really quickly, in fairness, though, the idea that the latest incarnation of the JFK community, you know, contains all these professionals, it always did contain an interesting array of characters.
Oh, yeah. I just mean the last one I think has been the most notable as far as after, you know, in the first, you had some professionals and experts in the first generation, but not as many. And then in the second and third, you know, in the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, you had more interin because it became more acceptable. But now I think it's gone pretty mainstream. It's not just, you know, what people could have once just dismissed as kooks and a couple professionals. It's now basically a lot of professionals. You know, of course, there's still going to be people who are unreliable, but they're not the mainstay anymore.
Mm. No, that's fair enough. But I think over time, that's what's happened because,
yeah.
You know, it has evolved. But the thing is that it's not as though there weren't doctors and lawyers and,
oh, yeah,
you know, and true experts in various fields that had gotten themselves involved, you know, the statisticians and... filmmakers.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of notable people who got involved. I think that as it's become more mainstream, it's become easier for people to get involved.
Oh, yeah, certainly. Again, the access that was created, the fact that we have the evolution in the communication should have been, you know, a light years leap for the information in general. But in some cases, you know, we learn that it can do almost as much harm as good sometimes. You know, like Larry said, look, you can't just rely on YouTube to, you know, get your information, although there are people who swear by it, right? You know, and that's unfortunate, and like I said.
Well, if you can at least, our humble, you know, your show, Chuck, and Larry's blog, my blog, and some of the shows that are on YouTube, at least we have evidence links. Mm. So it's not just YouTube. They can go somewhere else and check it out too. But you're right. That isn't the mainstay of YouTube.
Yeah,
most of YouTube is just the video and believing them.
Right. Exactly. So go ahead.
So in 2017, as Chuck, Larry, and I have prior mentioned, a huge wave of evidence was released. Not all of it, of course. But a huge wave of evidence was released by the National Archives related to the JFK and related matters. Of course, as prior mentioned as well, some of it was stuff that was already released and just redacted in different ways and thrown in. And some of it is copies of other documents in the collection. But tens of thousands of files, despite the legal mandate set by the ARB, were not released. Right. President Trump, who prior claimed he would release all the files, similar to other presidents, put a new 3-year extension on such a release, preventing them from release until 2021. Despite this ongoing battle for transparency, the files reaching the public have revealed a series of important disclosures. Among the files was a slew of new cryptographic or codename information regarding the CIA and FBI, confirmation of new figures connected to the intelligence groups, the role of older and recent figures with connections to the case and related subjects. We know now the true name of at least one CIA officer that considered using Oswald, and that same officer, like all other officials, also prior denied wanting to use Oswald. Matters long veiled in controversies, such as Thomas Arthur Valley and the Chicago plot, and allegations of exile involvement too have gained more clarity with the new documentation. Larry has written about this, and I included his blog post in the references, and I figured now might be a good time to see what he and Chuck thought about those particular matters, and Larry could tell us, you know, fill us in on some of the new developments.
Yeah, I have been fascinated by what I used to describe as the Chicago plot for a long time, because there was little bits of information that came out, you know, mainly through Edwin Black's article in the Chicago Monthly, which was something that had been shared around and was kind of out of context until we heard from Abraham Bolden some years later, where he provides his version of a story related to that. And a lot of things have come out regarding this. I'm satisfied that without looking at any of the new stuff, honestly, I'm very satisfied that there was something going on in Chicago. But it's not the easiest thing to sort of pin down in my mind, Larry. What is it that you've been writing about recently?
Yeah, I think what's really helped, a couple of things. First of all, as you said, Chicago tends to all get mashed together. Like, as you say, there was something going on in Chicago. There was a trip by JFK was canceled. There was a threat, and it becomes one thing, like the Chicago event. Whereas in reality, it turns out that there were three separate events. One event involving a threat expressed actually in a bowling alley diner where a fellow named Thomas Valley was having breakfast and said something to a guy that scared him so much he went to the Secret Service and said, hey, you need to check in to this guy. He could be dangerous. Entirely separate from Abraham Bolden's story about a teletype coming into the Secret Service from the FBI saying that there were people traveling to Chicago that might represent a problem for the president's trip. We don't know whether it said threat or anyway. So there was a warning message from the FBI that apparently generated some action. Both of those ended up in arrest, apparently, in the Valley instance. He was picked up, booked, charges were filed. We've got a long record on him. That's been known for some time. The reason it became more mysterious is, as you said, Chuck, a local Chicago newspaper person started looking into it and added a lot of sensational claims to it. What has helped straighten that out now is that we can see enough so that we know that the House Select Committee actually investigated both incidents and looked into the really sensational claims that Black had put forward, such as Valley's car was registered in the name of Lee Oswald. Hmm. Or Valley was, they searched the place where he worked, and rifles and ammunition were found there. Neither of those were true. But we can now see that it was investigated. But before, there were incidents that were mysterious. And they all got rolled together with yet another incident, which involved a remark from Thomas Echevarria to an FBI informant about JFK. As soon as JFK was removed by somebody, didn't say who, then they would be able to go into Cuba. And all of them kind of play together as something mysterious and now that we can separate them, what has really come clear is, especially, we have a new document in regard to the Echevarria thing before, and I wrote this. So, okay, this is my fault, and this gives you an excellent example of a writer creating a mystery when there really isn't one. I wrote it as if there had been no real investigation of the Echevarria incident, that it had been dropped for no obvious reason by both the FBI and Secret Service, and that it must be really incriminating somehow. Now we know, and I've been blogging on it, that the FBI and Secret Service, and particularly the FBI, did an extensive investigation of this incident over probably 6 weeks, including phone taps, surveillance, meetings and actually stings to get the full story of who was doing what and what was behind it. And it turns out to be much less mysterious than it was before. But that's the fact that we now know that it wasn't just dropped. there was an extensive investigation that we can see. So I can't revise the book right at the moment, but that's why I've been blogging on the Chicago threats at some length to try to separate those and put in links to the actual document and clear things up. And that we can do. And that's another place where the onus is on the authors and the researchers to go back and clean up their mysteries if they see that they can be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I highly respect that, Larry. That's what, you know, I think that everyone here supports is that that's why I always default to the scientific method. If new stuff comes along, you got to change what you said before and admit that, you know, it's new information. And there should be no judgment for that. That's how you're supposed to do it. We're supposed to go back and fix things when they're broken and then proceed.
I think another thing is it's too easy to make those things what you want them to be. I mean, who would not like a mysterious threat in Chicago? The Black story, which everybody quotes as newspaper articles, when you really research that, what you find out is that nobody ignored this Valley guy. The Secret Service reported it. They did a pretext call in his apartment 3 different times, talked to his landlady. She let them into his room. They did find a rifle and some ammunition in his room, not in his car when he was arrested, not at the place where he worked. And what you find out is, and I found it out the hard way by ordering his protective research file from the Secret Service and getting like 500 pages that I had to pay for back in the old days, because they kept him as a PRS subject for like a decade. They did not ignore him. They had the Chicago police manage to pick him up on a traffic violation. He got charged and he got picked up and searched because he didn't use a turn signal, something like that. So it wasn't ignored. And what I also found during the research is one of the things is that he puts forth as well, the route JFK was going to travel would have taken him past the place where Valley worked. Well, yeah, it would. And it was suspicious because it was a high-rise building. Now, we're in Chicago, folks. You know, there's probably no place where there's going to be a presidential motorcade where there is not going to go past a high-rise building. But what even got worse is I found a series of correspondence where for the better part of 2 years, Black actually pursued the 2 Chicago police officers who had arrested Valley. He harassed and threatened him so much that one of them moved from Chicago to Texas and Black followed him there. I mean, there was just like an obsessive level of thing going on with him trying to make a story out of something that really in the end wasn't fair. And I know people are going to listen to this and they're going to hate that because they want it to be true because it's been true for decades now. Sorry.
Yeah, I've even pointed to this story. You know, I've even pointed to this story myself, right, regarding the Black article. I pointed to it and said, you know, look, this is rather suspicious. When you factor in that there was some controversy also with the Chicago PD people, that, you know, like, in other words, you know, it's not just Edwin Black being a crazy guy who is a relatively respected journalist, by the way. But he did over-pursue this, from my understanding, and maybe because, you know, he saw some of the corruption that was part of what was going on in Chicago. But then again, maybe it was just to make a bigger, badder story out of it. I don't know. Hard to know what his motive is. But to say that, you know...
He was well-known for investigating corrupt police practices and corrupt city practices in Chicago, which is not hard to find. Certainly wasn't hard to find then.
Right.
So he did have a good reputation for that, but in all honesty, it's anybody can make a mistake.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, and it isn't always intentional, which I think people need to realize too, because there is a predisposition by people on both sides to want to jump on the other side if they see something wrong and act like it was intentional. And it is sometimes. I mean, but it's usually fairly obvious if it is. Most people are not going out there intentionally trying to mislead people. They're just giving their ideas, and they might be a little bit too excited to give those ideas and a little unwilling to take constructive criticism.
Mm. So well, it's not like the other part of the mystery is supposedly, again, his findings were ignored, right? As in the actual Vuorie case where I wrote about, well, they dropped the investigation, so this must be suspicious. Well, Black dug this stuff up, and they were ignored, so it must be suspicious. And then you found that the House Select Committee on Assassination took both the Valley and the Bolden incidents very seriously and did try to pursue the concrete claims that Black had made. It's just they did track down his driver's license. They did track down. Yeah, and it just didn't turn out to be true. And I must say, later on, I even made contact with Valley's family, who themselves had been very concerned because he did have psychological problems, and they had done a lot of their homework on their own because of some of those claims that confused them because they hadn't seen any evidence of him being in New York State training Cubans, and that's because there wasn't any.
Well, I think, too, that as much as I totally agree with Larry's assessment, and I think that that all makes perfect sense. But I think people also could have gotten misled because there were attempts by people with better connections to someone in the case than Valley who might have tried to manipulate this. Because I know at least for sure one account I read in the CIA informant files was from Richard Kane, the driver and fixer for Giancana. And he had sent a report to the CIA around 63, I think it was like September 63, saying that there were the Cuban exiles in the area plotting to kill Kennedy, trying to work with the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, which wasn't true. But he was feeding that.
That's a good point, Carmine, because I need to insert that this whole, once you segment this into three different stories, the research into Echevarria did find that there, and I've written this up and plan to write more about it, there were Cuban exiles traveling to Chicago that had indeed made threats against JFK. The Bolden aspect of this is very likely true. It's just that these guys got busted, and they did get picked up, but there was nothing in evidence that they could book them for. So they just got picked up and held. The trip got canceled. But there is every reason, even in the investigative report, you find that the FBI interviewed Cuban exiles that admitted that they were planning protest against JFK in Chicago. So I don't want to leave the impression that I do believe and write that there was an existing threat and talk against JFK, and there was something there. It's just these incidents have to be handled individually for what you can get out of them.
Yeah, they don't equate to the big, you know, roll up that some people have attempted to make of them. You know, by mashing them all together and trying to say that mashed mass represents something important rather than maybe the actual useful leads that might exist separately, and by showing that distinction is important. Yeah. A lot of things, I mean, I know you guys have seen it for, you know, decades more than I have. Just people, what starts off as one little story becomes 10 in 20 years.
And once you can compartmentalize it and take some of it away, then you're free to pursue the serious leads. And at the moment, we're tracing, the FBI did really identify the guy who had traveled to Chicago, who was a DRE military leader. They found him, and you can find in their files that these were the same DRE leaders that were going to Dallas. And you actually end up with a CIA officer writing a letter to the Warren, well, to the CIA and to the Warren Commission. He had worked with these DRE people, and he actually advised that they need to be intensely investigated because he himself thought that they had posed an outstanding threat to the president. So not like there was nothing there.
Yeah. Yeah. Just it's, it's going to take some more digging. I mean, that's, you know, unfortunately, when people want to settle for what is emotionally satisfying, it's not usually going to be satisfying when you actually have to come down to the evidence to prove it.
Oh, yeah. And there are whole documentaries devoted to the story seeming to fall together with, again, if you have limited information, the story does look kind of curious, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the names of the show. I think one of them was called Conspiracy Files that focused on this, but it was one of those things that sort of ripped through during the 40th anniversary. You know, made the rounds, and people were just like, oh, wow, this is the thing. You know, the Chicago plot was given a resurgence, kind of, in the public's mind. I mean, I even placed a TV report about it on YouTube because I found it rather curious, and with limited information, you know, again, you're left with these holes. And, you know, if you're not going to talk about it at all, then you're not going to, you know, that's your choices here. There's going to be holes in any of these narratives. So
it is, and just not to belabor the point, but, and that's why, again, the onus is on us. And I wrote something that was wrong. And I will say, when we're going beyond the ARB, one of the things that the ARB did confirm was that there was something real there, particularly in regard to the Bolden story,
right?
Because they went back and tried to interview these people in the Secret Service office, and they got stonewalled. In fact, they got stonewalled so bad that they showed documents to the secretaries who had their annotations of having typed the documents,
mm-hmm.
and the secretaries would say, I didn't type that, and they would go, but look, that's your mark down at the... Nope, don't remember that. So... again, the ARB did a good job, and I think this is where Chicago really resurfaced. I remember the Lancer conference where it really resurfaced because of this work for the ARB, and suddenly it was, man, there's got to be something to Chicago. And it turns out, yes, there is. It's just not everything.
Right. You know, the Bolden story, again, I put a bit of validity on that, and I think it's an important issue. You know, all together, but does that mean that we have, you know, some sort of a pre-plot to Dallas exactly here in the making? Well, not necessarily, but were there threats? Yes, sure. But you got to pull all these things apart, you know, piece by piece. And when a new piece of evidence comes in, you might have to adjust the cuts you make. I mean, it's just that simple. But look, we're going to take a quick break here. We are doing the JFK 101 series, going further into the future. You know, where is it we're going to wind up, is the way I see this. Anyways, Carmine Thomasano and Larry Hancock are with me, and so are you if you stick around. So try and do that. We'll be right back.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. The brilliant author of The War State brings you exclusive reports about the big changes upcoming in the markets. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
When a
fan of the Ocelli Effect calls in to the Ocelli Effect.
I just wanted to call in and tell you and Michael Swanson and JP Sottile and all of the guests that you have how much I love your show. Always interesting. It's always informative. I just wanted to tell you in person on the phone. I mean, I love you. I love your show. I love everything you do. I will always be there to support you. You know that.
We appreciate you so much. You have no idea.
Thanks. And most of our fans just send hate mail and death threats.
Shelly.com.
Entertainment, and more. You will learn something, children's. Ocelli.com.
So beginning very late into the second hour here at Ocelli.com with the Ocelli Effect, we are continuing on the JFK 101 series, Larry Hancock, Larry-Hancock.com. You go there, you can catch up on the blog, which, by the way, has some information related to part of what we discussed in the first hour. And, of course, Carmine Sabastano, my Thursday co-host over here every other Thursday at this point. Sinister History, the guy who is the author of TPAC, Two Princes and a King. So you go to TPAC.com, TPAAK.com, and you can learn about that. And also check out Carmine's blog, which I guarantee you is also related to these subjects in some cases, but contains a great deal of other information. Of course, Larry's the author of multiple books and all that good stuff. I advise that you explore the world of Larry Hancock, not just at his website, but, hey, just go over to Amazon or wherever it is books are sold and you prefer to buy them. Go ahead and check out Larry Hancock's work on everything from MLK to the national security state to UFOs to JFK, so on and so on and so on. Meanwhile, big apologies. We had a long break there, but big apologies. I had to traumatize Larry during the break. He actually got to hear me have a problem during a break. So a little bit of trauma there. Personal apology to you, Larry, for having to endure it. But I am here to finish this show out, baby. No matter what, the show must go on. Anyway, Larry, you still with us?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay. He stuck around, folks, even after listening to me. Actually, he just listened to me throw up during the break. Carmine was not there at the time. But Carmine is still with us, too, right?
Yeah, even after the story, I stayed.
Even after the story. Anyway, let's move
you gotta
forward.
You've got to be tough to stay with the subject. I mean, yeah,
exactly.
That's it.
Wouldn't be the first time we've had to deal with something that made us want to vomit.
Well, you know, there you go. Look, it would have been so much more appropriate had I done that during one of the myth shows, you know? But instead, we got it today, and it's not because of the company I'm keeping or the subject matter necessarily. But anyway, let's get to it. Carmine, where did we leave off? Because we were discussing the Chicago plot, which is the way I've described it for a long time. Larry has talked about how, you know, listen, new evidence emerges and you can make better sense out of pre-existing evidence and pre-existing narratives and storylines that you may have indeed thought were very good leads or were bad leads, but you have to adjust based on new evidence. That's clear. But where did we leave off here, Carmine?
Well, it was just after 2017, the releases. Some of the stuff Larry was covering was some of the new information that's come out since the 2017 releases. And, you know, several people have expanded our knowledge on, you know, the internal mechanisms and the organizational agendas that have been revealed in the new documents. We have additional evidence has provided disputes to unverified claims. It's offered multiple people, including a longtime myth maker featured on a past show, Antonio Viciana, who we've covered before from people like John Newman. Larry and I have discussed him. There's a lot of new information that is changing what once everyone thought was the case. So I think it's important that we, as Larry, you know, prior advised, we have to keep up on the information. Those of us who are going to be putting out information need the most current information that we can get our hands on. Because if we operate on older information, it can be mistaken because there was no greater access to the facts. There's a lot of interpretation required. And interpretation can, you know, leave the evidence trail and go off into various places. Mm. So, despite the tales offered by some unreliable witnesses, people on both sides of the research community have made expanding progress to clarify the facts, and in rarer cases, both sides can even work together on combating myths threatening the entire historical record. I'm grateful to Chuck O'Chelly for offering his knowledge in the rare forum to allow every point of view the opportunity to stand and fall on its merits. Unfortunately, a distinctly one-sided view has too long precluded reasonable people on both sides from possessing a more genuine accounting of the facts. Because the facts are not all one-sided. And the current truth of the matter is, no side has the definitive facts to determine the ultimate party or parties responsible for JFK's assassination, much less assign unquestionable guilt or innocence. So yeah. That's important.
That's the thing, and this phrase, the preponderance of the evidence, right? And this is not in anybody's favor as to the overall story here. The way I see it, I mean, you know, I lean in one direction nowadays. The funny thing is, I didn't always lean in that direction. But, I mean, the fact is, to sit and have somebody say that they have the complete story. That's the thing that always cracks me up, is I've got all the answers. I know everything there is to know. That is always the, like, wow, okay, now let's find out how far from the truth that actually is.
That's always a good marker for, oh, okay, I can't believe anything you say.
Well, yeah.
You think you know everything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was a guy, I love this story because it was a few years back, and I had not been doing a radio show or anything like that, but they just sort of were in my home, and they were a guest there, and they said, oh, you're interested in the Kennedy assassination? I said, yeah, I am, you know, and he said, well, I've read everything on it. And I said, oh, okay. So immediately there's red flag number 1, 2, and 3, because that's almost impossible for somebody to have read every single thing on it. And this is, again, like 10 years ago, right?
Yeah.
So there's more now. But I said, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. I'll just accept your BS for a second. How many books have you read? I mean, a number. Can you give me a number? Yeah, I forget if this gentleman, I've had this conversation more than once. I forget if this gentleman said 3 or 30. But either way, let's combine the numbers and say he told me both. Not good. not a reliable answer as to how many books you read. Forget about what you know about the case. You know, I said, well, you do realize there's about 1,000 of them out there, right? And I, at that time I was saying about, because it was kind of hard to, count them all. There, you know, Amazon has gotten a lot better and a lot of other repositories of this information have gotten a lot better about making more complete lists about what's available. But even so, there were people that independently released things called monographs, which are small books, and there were booklets, and there were articles and magazines devoted to, and, you know, come on, even Walt Brown's JFK Deep Politics Quarterly, to tell me that you've read every issue of that is kind of hard to believe. You know what I'm saying? It's there may indeed be somebody who has.
Well, I just want to insert, no, there isn't. Anyone who says they've read everything is a liar, because no one ever has. Because I actually talked to a mathematician friend of mine. If you started from the time when you could first read, mm-hmm. and you read nothing but documents, you'd never get through the whole collection before you likely died. And that's all your free time. That's no hobbies. You don't ever form real relationships with people. You just read documents all the time. You have no job. So it's impossible. Nobody can do it unless they're extremely wealthy and that's all they do. And see, they don't.
Yeah. See, now you make the point with the documents. I made the point with the books.
Yeah.
Larry, somebody who tells you that they've even seen everything related to the assassination, or they know everything related to the assassination. Have you ever had somebody tell you that?
You know, actually, I haven't. What I tend to experience is what you described earlier, I think, Carmine.
Uh-huh.
People come up to me either online or in person and say, well, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't start, and some of them start saying, I believe, and they've not looked at anything. And that has probably been my point of form in most cases, rather than, you know, those kind of claims. It's like, you believe something, why? Well, it's like it's an article of faith, isn't it? That's what you're telling me. And, you know, immediately you start looking for the exit. But that's
yeah.
been more, and I'm still seeing that. I'm on two forums today where I saw brand new people join the forums and say, kind of like, I believe, and what do you guys know that will confirm that? Wait a minute. That's not how this works.
Yeah, the definition of confirmation bias.
Yeah, here's my belief. Now fill it in with stuff. That's an interesting point. I see that more as it's kind of funny, because I thought that was an older generation problem. Quite honestly, and you know, no offense, Larry, you're the oldest one on the panel. You know, but the thing is, it seemed to me as though people in your generation would literally make that statement to me also when they, oh, you're interested in the case. Well, I believe this. And I would say, okay, well, you know, based on what? Not attacking them, just asking the honest question, based on what? And generally speaking, they had nothing to base it on outside of, guess what? Another belief. You know, it was like, well, I believe Johnson had something to do with it. Oh, okay. Why is that? Well, because I believe he was. Okay. Fill in the blank. And, you know, this is the kind of stuff I would hear from people 20, 25 years older than me a lot. And I would just say, wow, okay. And I would choose usually not to engage in the conversation after that, because what am I going to do against a guy's belief, you know?
And I'd say similarly on the other side, we have that sort of reverence for the commission. You know, we have that sort of people who want to believe the official story because, one, it's definitely more emotionally satisfying. I mean, because then you can believe that the government didn't, just overtly conceal huge amounts of information and lie to itself over and over. You know, that we don't live in a country where someone who is such a force for progressive ideals gets murdered in the street in front of people as an example to others who might try to do it. Mm. You know, that's why you want to believe that. I mean, who doesn't want to believe that we have order all the time?
It is interesting, though, because I, in particular, had Chuck's experience, because I'm from Oklahoma and used to spend a lot of time in Texas. And whenever I brought the subject up in Texas, the immediate response is, we know Johnson did it. Oh, how do you know that? Because we all know he was crooked and evil, and if he didn't do it, it's just because somebody did it first. And my immediate response was, and how many times did you guys elect this guy? But it's like everybody in Texas knew that he was crooked and evil, and they voted him into office, and so they just automatically suspected him. But to be more serious about that, and I think this is true for every generation, I see so many people that enter the discussion looking for confirmation that their favorite conspiracy of choice, what is the number one thing that they fear and think is responsible for all the evil in the world, and that's where they start. It's not at all open-ended. It really is, I believe this fill in the blank is really bad, and therefore they must have killed JFK. The end.
Mm. Like the people that absolutely believe that every single thing on the planet which is wrong because the secret societies control it. On some level, they have an argument to be made about an overt control by covert people. Okay? The people running the show are not always the people you see in public. I mean, that's true, but it doesn't necessarily follow that every single thing that's ever gone badly is can be laid at the door of the Freemasons, for instance, you know. But there it is. Well, the Freemasons and the Federal Reserve, and okay, so what's your evidence? Well, and then we get into some more of their beliefs, you know.
And then, yeah, just to conversely offer the same problem with the other side, you show someone that Alan Dulles lied to the entire Warren Commission repeatedly, that he met with people like Helms at his home to discuss things ahead of time before they ever got entered into the report. And how can you not question? How much more corruption does it require until you think, hey, maybe these guys weren't being on the level with us?
Well, and this, let me introduce, I think that makes me think of a positive point, a post-ARB, how things have actually gotten better. One of the things that really fueled a lot of beliefs like that is they could pick up a document and they could see a cryptonym or an alias, and they could, because you didn't know who that person was, mm-hmm. they could kind of assume that it was their favorite villain.
Mm-hmm.
And that for years that fueled, if you look at even good researchers, I've done it myself, it's sort of like, well, I don't know who that really was, but you know, it could have been. Now, the good news is at this point in time, we have identified so many crypts and so many aliases and so many pseudonyms that should not longer be a problem if people take the trouble to look it up. Because almost all of it, there are very few documents I can take now and look at a document and not refer to the crypt list on the Mary Farrell site. And we're going to be putting up a pseudo list and know exactly who's being talked about. No more interpretation, no guessing. And that opens up new leads and shuts down a lot of mystery. And that is a real element of progress. You don't get to speculate anymore.
I definitely agree. I only did the ones that, you know, I've worked on or that Matt Shuffley has contributed, but, you know, all of our stuff we've tried to put into the bigger Mary Farrell collection and help push their cryptoname database, because it is true. The crypts and the pseudonyms and the aliases are the keys to the intelligence lockboxes. if we can open them all, then we can identify who's doing what. And if we know that, then we can identify who could have been doing something with the JFK case. But until we know what they're doing, where they, and it also helps us know where they are. Like, the reason we can dismiss so many supposed people who people want to put there in Dealey Plaza or being involved is because we can use the documents to follow them to where they actually were. You know, Joseph Miltier, not in Dealey Plaza. He's in Quitman, Georgia. Johnny Roselli, he's in Las Vegas. You know, there's, and just Charles Nicoletti, he's in Chicago. Just those three guys, you know, and there's dozens of people who have been put in other places, but just removing those three men can wipe out 20 myths.
And the corollary to that is also that we're setting at a point of time in which there is an immense amount of collateral history that's now searchable. I'll give you a personal example. A week ago, we discovered two new CI officers that we had never known before that were as senior level as David Morales. Nobody's ever written about them. Nobody knows about them. They show up in a document. We can identify them. We can find more documents on them. But we can also find books that were written about things that they participated in that you would never know about unless you knew to search that name. For example, one of these people was serving in 1963, towards the end of 1963, with the new AmWorld project. Turns out he had been a senior PSYOPs aide to Lansdale in the Philippines. Served in Vietnam. He's got this whole career that was just invisible, but now I can search and see books written about the Philippines where he shows up. So that's one of the reasons I've been making the point that you just can't rely on what's been built over the last 40 years, because there's a lot of new data to be pulled in.
And I think that goes back to Chuck's point earlier about people who don't want to look at the new evidence. Well, then you're probably not going to solve anything. That's basically the answer to that. You know, I'm sure scientists, when they realized that the Earth was round, didn't want to have to go back and redo all the evidence and, you know, say it wasn't flat anymore. But eventually we did. It's going to happen. It can happen with you or without you.
Yeah, see, that's the interesting thing, is it's more about who's moving the conversation forward, not necessarily even who's solving anything, because,
yeah,
you
just
know,
who's, yeah.
I don't believe for a second, and I don't think for a moment, that I'm going to be part of solving anything, but I would like to be part of trying to clear away some of the things that are useless here. And the only way that we're going to do that is to keep reexamining things. I mean, like I said, I've admitted that, you know, even with some knowledge on this case that was pretty good and better than the average person's, I've been mistaken about more than one thing over time. You know, I find that all the time. You know, I mean, Carmine, have any of your positions sort of changed based on brand new evidence? You know, like, not immediately in the beginning. I mean, obviously, your head was twisting all different ways when you were looking through it.
Yeah,
but
I like to think of the first year as just waiting.
Yeah.
You're just waiting through the morass, trying to hold on to stable things, you know, so you can get some bearings.
But after the first 2 years, right, did you find that you had come to some sort of reasonable, okay, I'm fairly certain that this is the case, and then you come across more evidence and you go, wait a minute, I got to change what
I
thought about it.
Yeah, no, I think that everyone involved in this case who is operating on, you know, a rational level is going to need to change their ideas as time goes on. No one is going, it's like any criminal investigation. You don't walk in knowing the answer. People who walk in knowing the answer are wrong. You know, you how can you know what you haven't reviewed? If you haven't spent time looking over all the evidence, you haven't spent time looking at the witnesses, seeing the consistencies and the inconsistencies in their statements. If you haven't seen the mistakes other people, you know, that's one of the greatest, you know, it's, it might be counterintuitive, but one of the greatest resources we have are all the mistakes people made before us. I mean, people have said, oh, you know, we've gone over just, we've scratched the tip of the iceberg. But, I mean, there has been a lot of people who've said a lot of crazy and unsubstantiated and nonsensical and intentional things have also been inserted for disinformation purposes. They've wanted to drag this out, whether it was for the benefit of the official narrative or whether it was for financial benefit or whether it was because they wanted to be famous or whether it was because, like, you know, Richard Case Nagel, they had mental issues.
Or it was expediency because, you know, again, where do we start?
Right. I mean, it could even be just that. They wanted to be right.
Yeah, I mean, where do we start from? I mean, in my mind, the very first, you know, alleged investigation that was hastily pulled together and was wrong on so many counts is J. Edgar Hoover's.
Yeah.
You know, his initial report was completed in, what, 72 hours, Larry?
Yeah, and you would have think, you know, if you just spent that little time on it, that it would be better. No, just kidding. Yes, it was done. Well, actually, you've got his, I think so, whoever writes a memo on Sunday afternoon that they're starting to write the report. So,
I believe it was Belmont.
Okay, they're starting to write the report, and it's going to be very challenging. And you go, well, yeah, I can imagine how it would be, but the good news is after 72 hours, you can't know that much, so maybe it won't be that bad.
Well, and one of the lines in that document that I remember that I find amusing is when Belmont at the very bottom of it, though, goes, though it must be admitted that such an extensive investigation could not hope to be finished in less than a week. So, hey, yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, well.
We're still talking about it 55 years later. I don't think a week was going to cut it.
And Chuck, I'll be up front. You asked Carmine that question. I will say I, being a little slow, spent a full decade following bad leads. I mean, I've 10 full years, a couple of years at a time, digging deeply into something that, you know, it's like, okay, done with that pitch.
But
yeah, unfortunately, like I said, you know, and I brought up the most glaring mistake I ever made, which was the French gunman thing. I thought that was viable for a few years.
I got sidetracked. I didn't actually give you a full answer. I wanted to tell you probably the one that stands out most in my mind was I was very convinced early on that Hoover might have actually played a hand in a plot. Just because to me he always, you know, he was in the right position. He could manipulate the right people. He definitely helped guide the cover-up. I mean, there is no question to that he lied to the commission, he lied to Johnson, he lied to anybody whenever he thought it was necessary to protect the FBI's image. Right. So that is the case. I was right about that he was part of the cover-up, but there is no substantial evidence linking him to the plot, and I think the reason why I had that idea was because of the constant, people parroting the mafia having pictures of him.
Well, there's that, and then there's the reasonable assumption because
he is a dishonest villain.
Hoover had done a lot of dishonest things when it came to investigations, and it's unknown as to the amount of damage that he might have done to many people, honestly, still to this day. So you have this nefarious figure who has a huge legend around him, right? And, again, this is like the Johnson thing. Yeah, it happened in Texas, and Johnson, over the years, we've learned exactly who he was. Funny that Larry says, yeah, and you guys voted for him how many times? That's funny, but the thing is that over the years, it's been revealed bit by bit the legitimate criminality that was connected to Johnson, the legitimate lack of ethics, the legitimate seemingly, you know, not caring for anything at all tied to Hoover outside of his reputation, his FBI, and his source files that, you know, disappeared. This is almost a reasonable leap in logic where you go, well, this is a bad guy. And it
relies, unfortunately, on that our biological need to form patterns. And while that can be very useful in this case, because you can form good, solid patterns with enough evidence,
right,
we can also form false ones. and we're all capable of it, and we all do it at times.
Exactly, exactly. Larry, would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I think there, and that's where intuition can lead you astray. This gets, yes, we, having done it many times, absolutely, we, it's a trap. It's just way too easy.
Yeah. If everything seems to come together too easy, it's because it does.
Yeah. And I'll offer another thing to that, which is what has actually made me keep going. It's when you find something that you weren't looking for that things become really interesting. It's like if you're going down a trail and suddenly it's kind of like, well, I wasn't looking for that connection and there it is. Or I wasn't looking for that incident or that meeting, or if it's something that you actually just came out of the blue, then that can be significant.
And, you know, again, speaking about mysteries and how these things have evolved over the years based on the public and private pronouncements related to the evidence in the case, I mean, you have no further to look than the alleged assassin. Because over the years, you've seen waves of this is just, you know, a patsy, okay, that's the official explanation, fine. This is just, the patsy, comma, then there's the official explanation, not the two of them together. That paradigm kind of emerging. Then you see people claiming that, it isn't the real Oswald. There's a whole other paradigm here. The CIA is involved. And other people would push back against that, stating that, you know, there's absolutely no way anybody would ever use a guy like Oswald. Which, again, neither side definitively solved that, in my estimation.
Well, we didn't solve it, but we can prove it was a lie that they wouldn't consider using him.
It's a lie they wouldn't consider using him, but it's also a lie that he was like some sort of James Bond super spy, too.
True. Yeah. So, it still requires context. It can't be, yeah.
No, I'm providing both sides of the argument here best I can, right?
Yeah.
And saying that over time, though, we went from, you know, was this just a deranged kid? To, you know, maybe he was under deep cover, you know, serious CIA guy to, well, it looks like there were some connections here. Who knows what was really going on with him? And he is a weird figure considering how he went back and forth, you know, from the USSR. But was he used or was he convenient? Or, you know, you end up with more open questions, but you can refine these things so as to not accept some of the more extreme claims over time. And I bet that each one of us sitting here tonight has had a change of heart, so to speak, regarding Lee Harvey Oswald over time. You know, there was a point at which I wanted to say that he was innocent. I no longer make that assertion. I'm being very honest about my blatant mistakes here. Now, that is not to say that I believe he is the assassin. But to say that he's innocent is equally a problem. So this is the way I've come down on it. But at one time, I did feel as though, you know, we're looking at an innocent guy who was probably, you know, railroaded. And that would make some sense, given some very real historical facts regarding, well, first of all, Henry Wade, the prosecutor, who was collecting evidence here, and his people collecting evidence. You could say that, you know, based on pattern recognition again, it would make sense that he was railroaded by the local authorities at the behest of a Texas politician in order to shut down the whole situation. But was he entirely railroaded? Was he entirely innocent? These are not fully concluded questions in my mind. And this is just part of my debates about Oswald. There's more to it than that. The character of the man, his capabilities, his mission, whether it was self-imagined or assigned, all of these things are open to interpretation in my mind. But this has changed many times over the years in my head. So I'm wondering, Larry, has your view of Oswald changed over the time of your investigation into the case? Just that figure, you know, as far as where it is you would file him, what it is you would say he was, you know, was he just a patsy? Was he, you know, whatever. You don't even have to be specific, but, you know, give me a general idea if there's been some serious changes in your initial conclusions versus where you stand today.
Yeah, I think it has. There's been a dramatic change, and two things that have been a dramatic change for me is, at first, I really truly believed, being having a clinical approach, that if I fully understood all the evidence from the crime scene and from Dealey Plaza, then there was an answer. I truly believed that. Then I believed that if I fully understood Lee Oswald, what was going on around him, what was going on with him, what was going on, as you said, that would give me the answer. It took me a long time to realize that fully understanding Lee Oswald has much more to do with thinking of him as the assassin than anything else, because that might explain him as the shooter, but otherwise you just ended up with a diversion. And I have now come to believe that obsessing over Oswald is a terrible waste of energy. And quite frankly, that's what Oswald was intended to be. He was intended to be a diversion. And not all that much more. It's kind of funny because, this is a position I often wrestle with, and people would ask me, what would happen if Lee Oswald had a cold that day? Or he didn't, he didn't feel well, or he didn't go to the school book depository. And my answer is, you know what? It would not matter, because if a rifle traceable to Lee Oswald is found in the school book depository, he would immediately be considered a part of conspiracy. Attention would be directed towards him, and therefore towards Cuba, and it would be a diversion. I really have moved off that. It took me a long time to do it, but that's where I see Oswald's obsession now is a diversion from really looking at the crime.
And you know what? To Carmine's credit, he has not seemingly publicly spent a tremendous amount of time on Oswald. I mean, some, yes, but, only as a figure of interest. I would say that he has not suffered from the Oswald obsession, which some researchers...
Sure, he hasn't. That's obsessed with documents.
Well, there you go. But that is a great way to put it, is that some researchers fall into a trap of becoming like the Lee Harvey Oswald guy for a while, or, whatever. And it's like, at the end of the day, even if you know everything about him, what is it that you can prove related to? It's like, if I knew every single fact and every single moment of that day, and then I have to try and still link him to the assassination directly, it's still a whole other process. So all of that minutia, doesn't really amount to as much as a lot of people think it does. Carmine, what about your evolution or changes in your view of Oswald?
Well, honestly, I have always, and not always to the, to the betterment of my standing in some forums, I've always considered Oswald, I do think that he was manipulated, and he was, to some extent, a patsy, but I do not think he was the complete patsy that people would attribute to him. I think that he even could have fired a shot, and if he fired a shot, I think he fired the miss, because he had no practice. Mm-hmm. I definitely think he was involved in some way. And even if he, for people who want to believe that he had almost no involvement, even the patsy role is part of the plot. You have met with people. You have done enough incriminating things for them to push you into this. Now, you probably have no clue what the end game is, but you've still involved yourself with people that you can't trust that are taking advantage of you. So you have some culpability in what happens. Mm-hmm. You're not just a mindless zombie, as some would paint other assassins, acting at the behest of the strings of the puppet masters. You have some role in this, and it's possible, as some people, it is wholly possible that Lee Harvey Oswald could have been used as, I think Bill Simbich called him, sticky paper. He could have been used as flypaper, basically, and dragged along trying to pick up any Russian agents by using someone so provocative. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, that could have been the end of his intelligence use. And then he could have been utilized by people who knew the intelligence operators, or were the intelligence operators that used him earlier, and then used him later. So it could be two totally separate operations he was involved in. It, once again, we don't want to crunch it all up like Chicago.
Right.
We don't want to mix all these things into one thing and just think that is the answer, because that isn't the answer. There's a lot of compartmentalized occurrences in here that don't necessarily have to do with the other.
But what were your initial conclusions? I like where you're going.
Oh, I've only looked at one of the things that, you know, I can't remember what show, but one of the old shows, somebody said I'm cold-hearted when I look at some of these people. I have never put any personal stock into most of the people in this case. I think that Lee Harvey Oswald is the official suspect. That's the way I look at him. Mm-hmm. He is who officials say did this alone, and then there is the mountain of evidence that shows that is unlikely. Mm-hmm. So I don't think he's innocent. I don't think he's wholly guilty because, like I said, the practice is important.
Right.
A lot of people who support the official side don't want to go into that, but he had no verifiable practice. The story of Morena, the one story that they always try to cling to where he messed with the bolt and he was sitting out in the yard, you know, not even firing. Once again, he doesn't have any firing practice. He's just playing with the bolt. Even that changes in some of her versions. To me, the more interesting person in the Oswald couple is not Oswald. It's Morena. Morena is the more interesting one, because Morena actually has some real important unanswered questions and things that have changed over time that she's never been consistent about. And once again, if Oswald, for all of his background connections and things, we can't actually prove that link him to intelligence operations. There's some that link Morena possibly to foreign intelligence operations.
Mm-hmm.
And that never comes up because a lot of people want her to endorse them, or they want her to give them an account of something they want said. But that doesn't mean that she's telling you the truth.
And the good news is both sides, or even three sides, can find exactly that. Because you get three different things.
Right. Yeah. And this by no means means that anybody is endorsing that ridiculous theory out there that Oswald is the Russian agent who might have, you know, therefore the Soviet Union might have been responsible. There was a whole TV show devoted to it, you know, a whole series.
I think if either one of the, and, you know, and this is, I am just speculating, giving perspective from some of the documents I've seen. What interests me most about Morena is that of the two of them, she might have actually been the one that was directly used by an intelligence group, because the CIA was worried. Jox Richardson, the guy who had interest in Oswald, which I don't think is a coincidence, was worried about Morena because they had seen a pattern of 12 other women that were released by the Russians marrying Western men, and then would go back to the country, divorce them or leave them, and then remain there as possible sleeper agents.
And then when you consider that multiple alleged American defectors are being met by the same woman in some cases, it's sort of like, well, let's see if Morena wants to go with this guy. No? Okay, well, leave it. So there you go.
And she has access to the P.O. box that he supposedly received the Carcano one. That's another interesting.
Well, you know, you go. There's a whole thing about that paperwork and everything, but that's a story for another day. We have a few minutes left here.
To tie a bow on it?
Yeah, I kind of want to do that, so go ahead.
Okay. It's a really good mini-myth, but I don't think we have time for it. We'll have to throw it in on a future episode. But suffice to say, I'll actually try to crunch this down because I think we've gone over a lot of the problems with the myth, so I'll have to cover this in a future episode, but let me try to put a bow on it here. So elsewhere in the case, a more recent development that we can talk about here at the end of the show is the 2019 initiative to reopen the JFK, MLK, RFK, and Malcolm X cases that was offered publicly by researchers, former investigators, members of victims' families, and conspiracy advocates. Unlike prior attempts to generate greater awareness and incite action, this latest statement was actually carried in at least a few major news outlets. As we bring the first series of the 101 to a close, I wanted to thank all those supporting our efforts, the many listeners who have enjoyed our presentations, and hopefully those listening for the first time who will gain useful ideas and facts to help them defend against the unreasonable claims without proper evidence. I want to say thank you to Chuck and Larry. It's been an interesting journey, and the next leg I'm sure will be interesting as well, once we figure out exactly what the format, if we're going to do suspects, or what we're going to do in all the new shows. But if you guys have any ideas, please email Chuck, and I hope you had a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and a very big thanks to, you know, Larry especially, because, you know, Carmine and I could probably sit and do this together, but the fact that we have the benefit of Larry Hancock with us during this entire series has been absolutely priceless in my estimation. So, I still have people message me discovering it now, telling me that they cannot believe that they're hearing this from three distinctly different angles, but we come together to make a reasonable explanation out of all of this during the 101 series. I'm very happy that that's the way it works for you. Now, before we close, though, I got one other question, really quickly, Carmine, because, you know, literally the first time I saw about this initiative to reopen the case, and I've heard in the past about trying to impanel or become part of some other grand jury procedure, this kind of thing, a lot of different lawyers talking about different ways to sort of get the case reopened, reexamined, so on and so on. I didn't really see it out there in the news feeds, and I found that kind of strange. I first saw it on the Neapolis Media Group's Twitter feed, honestly, before I read up on it. Yeah, and I was shocked.
Yeah, I the major sources I was talking about is I saw it covered briefly on Google News. It was listed under a few different like smaller news groups, and then one, the Washington Post was the biggest one that I saw. And there was one Washington Post article.
But, Carmine, I'll have to ask you this, and because I have seen this in the original release, I saw it get no coverage, and that is the fact that at least two of the Kennedy family members have stated that Robert Kennedy told the family in confidence that he absolutely knew that there had been a conspiracy involved in the assassination. And that seems to have gotten no traction whatsoever. And I'm amazed by that, because that's the kind of bombshell that you would usually expect. And he told them why, that he was not going to pursue it at that point in time. I haven't seen that covered anywhere.
Which, by the way, is a bombshell on many different levels, because for decades, the Kennedy family has effectively remained silent regarding the assassination. They haven't gone, you know, occasionally they make a statement, but it's usually not about, you know, whether they want to see another investigation or if they have questions. No controversial statement in my mind has ever, and lots of reporters have tried to get them, and lots of reporters have tried to represent certain comments as being off the record, you know, John Jr. said this, and all sorts of allegations about what might have been, could have been, should have been, but never before have I seen a public pronouncement from a legitimate Kennedy family member that kind of supports the idea that we need some more investigation here. Larry, am I incorrect about that?
No, the closest I've come, we had one of the Kennedy family cousins speak at Lancer for a couple of years, lovely lady, and she went as far as saying that it was, all she would say is that it was a point of discussion within the Kennedy family out to the level of the cousins, that it was expected that no one would talk about it. That was a family expectation. They weren't ignoring it, that they were intentionally refusing to comment. And and that she said, and you know, I'm not comment, I'm just telling you that this is a family position.
Right. And
which has been broken now, which it should be. That should have. We see so much make the tabloids. How did that miss?
Well, because one, there's this guy called Donald Trump. The news sources cannot seem. Like I said, I would like to reissue my challenge. A day. I'd like to see the news sources for a day not use the word Trump. Just one day. Just one day. Report on something else. On something more important, because God knows more, what he says is not the most important thing happening every day.
But you're right. I mean, that's it. That we have been so consumed that every day my wife asks me, well, you know, give me a synopsis of the daily news. And it's like, President Trump, That's it. There's nothing else.
Trump the SAG Awards.
Right.
I know there's something going on here. I know Britain has this little problem with you. I know there are the things going on. There's something about Venezuela. I don't know. Beats me.
Yeah, and unfortunately, things like this petition and, you know, similar, you know, worthy causes go unnoticed because people are, that's one of the things actually, and I'm definitely going to, you know, see if I can get Larry to check it out, to get some of his feedback on it, and Chuck too, but the book I'm working on right now, one of the things I'm talking about is what inspires, you know, these patterns of violence and aggression, and the Trump thing is a perfect example. It's, you know, when your anger goes beyond rationality, when it becomes a habit,
well,
that's
that,
not
good. Yeah, that's the thing here, is that regarding all of this, what we have to retain at all times is our ability to make rational judgments regarding what is important and what is not. And that's whether you're talking about the 24/7 news cycle that is dominated by the guy with the spray tan, or you're talking about, you know, the important historical facts and realities and what might be yet to come, including world events that are happening all around us all the time that just don't seem to be, I don't know, sexy enough to make the what bleeds leads paradigm out there in the news. It is not all that the world is made of that they show you on the cable news networks or on your podcast of choice. So you've got to utilize multiple sources. You got to look at things from multiple angles. And at all times, you have to really think for yourself with a rational basis in logic and also order by setting priorities about what it is that is important to you and to the rest of the world. So I think that's the way to take a look at this. And again, I want to thank Larry Hancock, Larry-Hancock.com, if I can get that straight, would be his website. Check out his blog there, especially related to the topic tonight. But of course, just check out Larry's writing all together. Many, many books, Surprise Attack, Unidentified.
Nexus.
I mean, it's
Creating Chaos.
Creating Chaos, which is a brilliant piece of work that we did two shows on here just with me and Larry. See, no Carmine on those. You know, for those of you that don't like his laugh. And meanwhile, Carmine Savastano, TPAK, TPAAK.com. That stands for Two Princes and a King, which is literally the book that Carmine wrote, which is a concise review of three assassinations from the 1960s. So I want to thank everybody who has gone through this. And if you're hearing this show first, let me tell you, there's a whole series of 101s to go back through, and I advise that's what you do. Meanwhile, we're all done with the Ocelli Effect for tonight. And again, thanks to Larry Hancock and to Carmine Savastano and to you, the listener, because after all, without you being here, there would be no purpose for us to do this. And you, after all, are the effect. I am merely Ocelli. Have a good night.